Good morning, and I'd like to bring to order this meeting of House Education Committee. It is 8:05, and present are Representative Keller, Munoz, Edgman, Gardner, Book, and Chair Seaton. This time, I want to remind everybody to turn their cell phones off or check them. Today, we are going to take up two issues. One is a report from the memorandum number 96 on the Anchorage School District website that can be obtained for anybody in the listening audience. And this is a longitudinal study looking at eighth graders that were in 2002, 2003, and following that group of students all of the way through their five-year career. In fact, those that took as a five-year seniors as well. And looking at dropout rates, and the factors that they could identify as why folks dropped out. This committee has talked often and long about making sure we rely on research and real data information to drive our decisions, and so I'm really pleased that this fine piece of research has come from an Alaska school, because it's very much more appropriate to us when we can have something come from Alaska. This also correlates well with a study that was done by the Juneau School District to tell us about, you know, our kids here in Alaska. So I'm very pleased with that. Wanted to let everybody know that on Monday we are going to have, partly it's going to be like a seminar. We have the book that most everybody received. They were all mailed, but some of them didn't show up in offices. So we have the author, Daniel Pink, of the book A Whole New Mind, and the new book Drive, which is talking about the science of motivation. And we've got a DVD of him presenting the book, A Whole New Mind, which we're going to be looking at in relationship to criteria we need to make sure that we balance on any kind of a future scholarship program, so that we come out in the end with, you know, advocating for and changing education for the goals we want in the end. So this will be a discussion topic. We may agree, we may disagree, but we need to have considerations of those things. I know that we've received more books in this committee for committee reading than we ever have before. Representative Keller suggested a book, and we had that distributed. We bought them for everybody. And this is the second in books, and as I hope I'm not flooding the committee with too many articles, but we get the Eclipse each week or several times a week, which is educational clips that are highlights from around the country, and those that I think are particularly appropriate to things that we are considering and working on, I have been forwarding to all the committee members. So I hope that, I don't think there's too many, I'm really reducing them down, but the reason I'm forwarding those is because they will relate to something that's happening in another state that we're going to be discussing, you know, when our committee time. So if there's any, as we go forward throughout the session, if there's other items that legislators think are really right on target with something we need to consider, make sure you let me know, and we will try to make those things available as well. Since this is a new session, I wanted to bring up and let everybody know that as we consider bills in this committee, it will be a very rare circumstance where we will move a bill on its first hearing. What we want to do is have a hearing. There will be some discussion on that bill. We want the public to have heard that discussion so that they can get back with their feedback to us between that and the next hearing on a bill. So sometimes we will have more than two, but almost always, even on education committee bills, we'll always have at least two hearing so that we can get full public input on it. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee before we start? Yes.
Has anybody finished reading the book and let me borrow it over the weekend?
We can arrange that. Anyone else? I was getting through some technical things, but Representative Keller.
Thank you. Do you have other DVDs or you just have one? And
we just have one. Yeah.
Because I'm going to have a conflict and I really am
uncomfortable
with that. But.
I think it will be, hopefully it'll be covered, but we'll have it in the committee. I bought it for the committee so that we could have it, and that will be available.
So if I borrow it over the weekend, don't bring it on Monday?
Yeah, you would be reading. Anything further? We're joined by so today we have those two things. We're going to be discussing this Memorandum 96 research from the Anchorage School District, and then we will be taking our first hearing on HB 235, Professional Student Exchange Loan Forgiveness. What's that? Oh, and I wanted to recognize that Representative Wilson has joined us. Thank you. Superintendent Como, are you on?
We are. Can you hear us?
We can very well. So I appreciate that. I don't know if you heard any of my introductory remarks, but we appreciate the school districts not only working on this, but putting forward an excellent publication. So if you wouldn't mind helping the committee look through this, and we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Seaton and the committee, for allowing us to do this. I do have the authors of the research report with me because I think they can answer specific questions. Laurel Voracek, our Executive Director of Assessment and Evaluation, and Dr. Xiaogun Sung is our Assistant Director of Assessment and Evaluation, and they did the research report. But I thought if I could start with just what we're trying to accomplish here, and then we're here to answer any questions, or Laurel and Xiaogun will be happy to add to my remarks and then answer questions. We, as you know, like everyone, we've all been struggling with how do we increase our graduation rate so that all of our students are getting a high school diploma rather than dropping out or focusing on a GED. We have a strong sense that we want young people to have a high school diploma, but we've been struggling trying to figure out what are the factors that can help us early on in the middle school area, especially predict which students are in danger of dropping out and which ones are at risk of not being able to get that diploma within the 4 years. So we've been lucky in this district to use a number of funds that we get some grants. We've used with some of our increased revenue through the legislature in the past couple of years, but particularly this year with our stimulus funding, we have been able to hire middle school career guides, and last year out of the general fund we hired graduation coaches for each of the comprehensive high schools and part-time for our alternative schools to really hone in on young people who are struggling and at risk for not graduating. And we're gathering data on those positions and people and what impact they're potentially going to have. We are still struggling with our math program, and we're going to do an in-depth review over this next year on our K through 8 math programs, because we're finding it's not working for a great number of children, some of which leads then to one of the major predictors of young people being able to take Algebra 1 in the 8th grade. And I think Laurel and Dr. Sun will be able to talk about that a little bit. But we know we have got to do a better job of figuring out how to help more young people be proficient and successful in math starting in kindergarten and working up. Part of that challenge is that we have to help our teachers feel competent and comfortable teaching math, not just computation, but the whole problem solving, statistics, and so forth. And some of that goes to, frankly, teacher preparation, but that's all related to this eighth grade predictor that's in this report. So we're working on that. And then finally, the other thing is we're finding that because of our math programs in K-8, they're very foreign to the way many parents learned math, and so there's a great struggle with families feeling comfortable helping their children with math. And we hear that repeatedly, whether people are engineers or people have a language barrier. As you know, we're extremely diverse and many English language learners, and so we're really struggling with that whole area, but we're working on it. So I'd like to ask Laurel if she could kind of give you a highlights of the predictors, and then maybe the two of them talk about anything they found while they were doing the research, and then I think we'd be better to open it up for questions from you, if that's okay.
Thank you. And Superintendent, I'm not sure that you introduced yourself onto the record. Could you place yourself on the record as well?
I'm sorry. I'm Carol Como. I'm the superintendent of the Anchorage School District.
Thank you, Carol.
Sure.
And when people switch, would you make sure, speaking, would you make sure they identify themselves for our secretary? Thanks.
Emily, thank you.
Okay, I'm Laurel Baracek, and I'm the Executive Director of Assessment Evaluation. And I'm going to just give a brief overview of our report, and then certainly we can answer questions that you may have regarding this. But we really, we have been following in our district the Chicago Public Schools work, John Easton, when he first came out with their on-track indicator in Chicago. We started right that following year, because through our work with the Council of Great City Schools, we were, I became quite intrigued with that, and so we really adopted in our board goal an on-track indicator. But what we wanted to do through this research was, one, find out whether the on-track indicator that we had identified was a strong predictor, and the other was to really look at, take a cohort of students and follow them from eighth grade till graduation and see what factors that we can identify through our system that gives us indication of the likelihood that that student is going to graduate in those 4 years. And so we really had to look at what data we can quantify. And, you know, there are many other factors that, you know, such as adding graduation coaches, advisory programs, adding on, oh, we have so many intervention supports, taking, you know, summer school, the courses, the online courses, the alternative programs. It's very difficult to measure their impact because you can't quantify that. So this is a study of factors that we could quantify. And so one of the first things that we did was we really looked at our cohort that we identified and tried to determine, looked at the characteristics of the cohort. And one thing that really, again, confirmed what UNO had found in a previous study, I believe Fairbanks as well, one of the things that when you're talking about dropouts or graduation rates and data, it really depends upon how you define, have a clear understanding of how that data is defined. For example, in this group, 46.2% of the students who dropped out were white. And so you could look at that and say, well, you know, our Caucasian white students are dropping out at a much higher rate. But you then look at what percent of the cohort they are, of which, you know, for this eighth grade cohort that we followed, they were 57.8% of the cohort, so they were dropping out at a lower rate than their representation in the cohort. The one group of students who was dropping out at a higher rate than their representation in the cohort was our Alaska Native American Indian, and it was at almost about double the rate. So we really, again, our Indian education program and our entire, we've been, you know, been looking throughout the district on how we support Native education. And last year, Carol added, was able to find where we added some more teachers to support that, because we knew that we needed support and still need to provide more support. We also, in looking at the students who dropped out, that GPA, definitely, when you know, about 73% of the students who dropped out had a GPA of 2.0 or less. So that certainly was an issue that we could be more closely looking at. But one of the surprising pieces, before we get to the predictors, when we looked at the assessment results. Because when we took this, looked at this grade, eighth grade cohort, even though they're not, they're, when again, our two groups are our graduates and those who did not graduate or dropped out in the 4 years. And the students that were fifth year were not included in the study because otherwise you would not be able to have the two groups for the control. And so one of the things that, was helpful for us to really understand and to see is that the majority of our students who dropped out in eighth grade, I mean, when we looked at their assessment results in eighth grade, they were proficient in reading and mathematics. When we looked at their ninth and tenth grade scores, the majority were proficient in reading. They dropped in math, I believe, just a little bit below the 50th percentile in 10th grade, but were okay, or were at that in ninth. And so, again, what we were, what that helped us to see is that it's not just ability, that there are a lot of other issues that are, that contribute to whether a student drops out. And so then if we, from, you know, after analyzing all of those, we really then went to the regression analysis where we determined when we looked at all of our factors that we could gather statistically, which, let's see, they are listed on page 19 in the report, which lists all the variables. We wanted to be able to see which one statistically were predictable of an out, where the outcome would be graduate if you had it, the odds of you not graduating were very good if you didn't have it. And what we were able to determine through that regression analysis, that receiving less than two semester F's in core classes in grade nine was statistically significant. If they get if right now our high schools are looking at, if a student has an F in a core class, that is immediately a red flag, because if we can't remedy, intervene early with that, the chances of those students dropping out are very high. The other was the number of credits. Earning at least five credits in grade nine, in terms of looking at how that impacted our practice, we were already providing a lot of opportunities to be able to catch up on credits, but certainly it was intensified through our summer school program. And we, Mr. Henry and our high school division, we no longer, once you reach so many absences, you were not dropped out of the school program, you were provided an opportunity in an alternate setting or an alternate class to be able to earn those credits. So we really started looking at how we can hang on to kids and provide them with more opportunities to get back on track with their core requirements and with their total number of credits.
And Laurel, before you go on, I just wanted to know, did you look at just in core classes, or did you also look at receiving two F's in any classes, or was that just not analyzed, or did you analyze and then not in, have this in the list?
We only analyzed the four core. Just a minute, shall I get to you? What page is that?
Page 15.
But those are the four classes.
Yep.
We did not analyze F's in art or F in music or PE, but we did look at whether or not taking courses in, because we had really looked at a lot of the national research, which really was had identified the course. So no, we did not look at the non-core classes, but we did look at whether or not taking a performance arts class, a career tech class, had any statistical significance in predicting the outcome, and it did not. So really, our research supported what was nationally in that it's focusing on those core classes. But when I say that, where you catch those F's in the other areas is in the total number of credits, as well as the GPA.
Okay, and can you refresh for the committee here, who don't deal with it every day, how many credits would a normal, would a student that completes all of their courses without ifs in their freshman year, how many credits would they get?
Six would be is most of our high schools, because it's six periods a day.
Okay, so thanks on that. I just hate to break things up, but I think that as we go through these, they're detailed enough that if people have questions for explanation on an issue, we'll need to interrupt with questions at that time. Does anybody else have any explanatory questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might have heard you wrong, but when you went over the dropout rate and were looking at those children or those students, you found that they were proficient, and you said reading and math. Was it reading and writing, or was it reading and math?
If you look on page 7 on the assessment results, the outcome of the dropouts, this was for 8th grade, in reading, 54.7% were proficient, writing 61.4% were proficient, and math, it was 45.1%. So no, I said that incorrectly. It was reading and writing.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Laurel. Go ahead.
Any other questions before I?
Not at this time. Go ahead.
The next factor, that predictable factor that we found, was attendance. And really it was looking at attending school 80% of the time in grade 9. And this one has been sometimes misinterpreted, even within our own district, to mean that, well, if you only have to attend 80% of the time. Basically, when we did this analysis, we looked at 80, we looked at 85, we looked at 90, and we looked at 95. What we are we're trying to do is to determine where the outcome, at what point is the outcome significantly different for those who graduate in 4 years versus those who drop out. Naturally, if you attend 95%, 90, or 85%, that's going to be in your favor. But when we did the analysis, where it clearly distinguished those who would drop out versus those who would graduate was at the 80, for those who attend school 80% of the time, less than 80% of the time. So that was, and certainly that is supported in a lot of the national research too. And then the next factor that we found predictable was passing algebra in eighth grade or earlier. And when we're looking at,
did we hear you say page 18?
Page 18, yes.
Okay, thank you.
The analysis indicated that students who pass Algebra 1 in grade 8 or earlier are twice as likely to graduate in 4 years as those who do not pass Algebra 1. And what that tells us is that students who are at that level of math in their eighth grade year have a much greater likelihood of graduating in 4 years. And certainly as a district, Superintendent Como has already talked about how we are really going to very closely be looking at our math program, because just like with the National Math Panel, the focus needs to be on those skills to prepare those students to be ready for algebra in eighth grade. And what our challenge is to get more kids ready for those skills. Not necessarily to say, well, you're not going to, you know, graduate, but your odds are so much better if you're at that level. So we need to find more ways to get more students to that level. And that also requires us to increase our standards so that we are teaching those skills that are absolutely essential so they're prepared. The last thing we would want to do would be to put kids, more kids into Algebra 1 that are not prepared for that. And so when I'm looking at it in terms of this information with the district, it is one of the pieces that is really contributing to our current discussion on our math curriculum, and that it doesn't seem to be meeting the needs of some of our students.
Excuse me, Laurel. I think we have different pages. The our page 18 is talking about credits.
Okay. The algebra piece is one off of our website, that and we updated, we added more information into that. So I'm not sure on the original one where the passing algebra one.
I'll look while she keeps talking.
Okay. Thank you. We have the September 28th.
You have the same one I do, because I gave that to you. Yes. They've updated it since then, I think.
Yeah, we added because they wanted more, our school community wanted more information
page
on the passing number one.
And I think we're being told it's on page 20.
Okay. But basically, for one, 95.9% graduate in those 4 years. So if you're in Algebra 1, in your eighth grade year, you're also going to be having the attendance and being committed to school, and you're going to graduate in those 4 years. The other one that we found statistically significant at the 0.05 level rather than the 0.01. 0.01 means that there's only a 1% probability that this is due to chance and not due to the real influence. And so using the 0.01 statistical significance test is a very high bar. We did find, too, that the student's GPA in grade 9 was statistically significant at the 0.05 level. And so I'd like to share with you
Maybe it's on the new copy, but I didn't find in there what GPA, just that GPA was. I mean, is that the GPA 2 and above, or 3, or 4, or?
I would encourage you to, let's see, what?
Yeah, it was 2.0 in the summary.
But I really want to point out what page that shows the drop, or the GPA, there's a chart.
Representative Seaton, in the summary, it's 2.0, but she's going to find the chart itself.
Okay, I presume that that's added on the website, and we can pull that up and get it to the committee later, because I don't think we have that chart in the research that we have.
Actually, this was in the original report. Oh. It is on page 17 of ours, and Superintendent Como will look at for the original one. And basically, right there.
Yeah. It's on page 18 on the one I gave you, Representative Seaton.
Okay, and that is?
It's figure 10.
Figure 10, okay.
Look at the relationship between the number of credits earned in grade. No, that's the credits.
That's the credits.
Where is the GPA? Well,
you can get back to us later on that.
If you look at figure 9, it doesn't list it by GPA, but it lists it by number of F's.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Page 16, so maybe 17 of yours.
16.
What page is that?
Yeah, we have the number of F's.
Which you can see that relationship, because it's going to go linear just like your GPA would. You can see that if you have zero F's, 88.2% graduate in 4 years, you get to one F, and your chances of graduating drop down to 70.9. More than one F, your chances of graduating 4 years drop down to 38%. So your GPA progression would be the same. And I know we have in here, I just can't find it right now, the piece on the GPA. Oh, page 6, table 7. Seven, 72.8% of our students who dropped out had a GPA of less or equal to 2.0. When you get up to 2.01 to 3 point, there you have 17% dropped out, 10% from the 3.01 to 4.0. So when you're looking at the relationship between GPA and dropout, when you look at the first two rows, that goes up to a 0.1 and a 1.01 to 2.0, 72.8% of our dropouts had a GPA of 2.0 or less.
Yeah, I thought it was, I find that table, I had...
Table 7 on page 7 of the document I gave you.
Right, and I think several of us found it interesting that 10% of the dropouts had a 3.1 to 4 average as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
it shows that there are a lot of factors that enter into kids dropping out, and this is what we're trying to ferret out to see how we can re-engage young people who are obviously proficient and above, just something's going on that has them focusing more on dropping out, and that's one of the things we're working on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Our goals are all the same here, I'm sure. So, great. Go ahead on. I don't see any other questions on this.
The one thing that report that the committee may want to consider reading in that is, when we're talking, when you notice the 10% from the 3 to the 4 point, that there are the reasons for dropping out are multiple. And again, we talked about in this report that it can only be things we can quantify. There is a report of a national study that was done by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's the Silent Epidemic Perspectives of High School Dropouts. And I can forward that to Superintendent Como, who could send it on to the committee. But it's one of the, we tried to replicate this study in our district, and we may need to look at it again. We were not successful because the return rate was so low that we really didn't have data that could be valid or reliable because of our low numbers. But they really are looking at from the perspective of the student, why did you drop out? And again, what they found, which is what we found in our study, was that ability is not always the issue. And most of the students who dropped out in this national study felt that with more supports they could have been successful. And so it really does give the qualitative piece that the only way you really can gather is to be able to talk to, have focus groups with students who drop out. And a challenge with that is that the students who drop out are difficult to be able to get in touch with and respond possibly to a survey or a focus group. But that one definitely deals with the qualitative, because there's a qualitative piece that we can't measure in a quantitative study. And then the only other piece that I would add to this is that what we are doing now to take this another step further with this data is we are in the process of implementing a on-track, an early warning system in our own district, where we have taken the factors that we've been able to identify through this research and are programming it so that our principals, our coaches, graduation coaches, our counselors, they're going to be able to run this report on the fly on their ninth graders and basically each one of these factors, it gives you if you fall into that category, it gives you a risk so that you have a total risk number, and plus you can also look at it from attendance, GPA, behavior, the grades that they've earned, so that they're constantly being able to monitor the students. And one of the critical pieces is addressing the attendance issues right early into the ninth grade. So that's the next step that we're moving toward, is that knowing these factors, we want to make it easy for the school to be able to be constantly monitoring these students, so that when a graduation coach is working with a student, they also could run this report to see whether or not their at-risk score has decreased with the support that they're providing, because they can run it on any day, any quarter, any semester. And so that's where we are moving. We always look at how can we impact that, make the information and data more easily accessible to the school. So that's the next step that we have taken from this.
And I just wanted to say that, you know, on our page 7 in the report, that was a very telling sentence where you said the number one category for dropping out is non-attendance. Number two was for unknown reason, and this supports the research indicating that dropping out of school is a gradual disengagement rather than a single event.
Absolutely.
And I think that is much of what we've been concentrating on here, too, is trying to see if there's anything from the committee standpoint we can do to sponsor engagement of students in school and making sure that continues. And we did have a report or a testimony from Kenai Peninsula the other day. We were asking them about their advisory programs that some of the high schools have and some don't. And it seemed like, I think it was 15% to 17% increase in or decrease in dropouts with the schools that had the advisory program. And so that was a very interesting thing for us. And I think that your question about why kids drop out, or maybe in that advisory program, we can ask them to, if they're having that engagement, we can look towards that kind of an exit exam, or not an exit exam, but a exit interview, so that we can maybe figure out a little more data that way as well. So we have Representative Gardner, and then Representative Wilson, and Representative Book.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. My question actually is to the same area of the report, which would be, for those who have a different printout, Table 8, the breakdown of dropout categories. And kind of a couple questions. I know that students can be expelled for, you know, obviously dangerous things like bringing weapons on campus or drugs. And I'd like to know if, number one, if there are other categories of things that will result in suspension. Secondly, what are district programs for students who are suspended or expelled? And then lastly, there's a category here called administrative drop, and I'd like to know a little bit of explanation about what is an administrative drop.
I'll talk a little.
Miss Carol Como, let me start with the first two, Berta, Representative Gardner, and then I think Laurel can talk about the administrative drop. We follow the federal and state law on firearms with an automatic recommendation for expulsion, and we also have two drug and alcohol violations is the recommendation for expulsion. But what we have done this year, you may have read about it, is we've been working very collaboratively with McLaughlin, the Department of Juvenile Justice, Health and Human Services, and the city on the step-up program that we've established for students who've been expelled. Even if they've been expelled for firearms and weapons, we have established a program. It's 20 is the maximum students. They're housed in a separate facility. They have been expelled, but we are providing a teacher and administrative support, and we bought technology to support the program. Juvenile Justice is providing probation support, to be there, and it's already showing results. We're going to put a report together at the end of the year, which we'd be more than happy to share with you all. But we're trying to develop and put together alternative programs for students, even if they have been expelled. The continuation program is another program we've started with district funds completely for students who've been expelled for drug and alcohol offenses and nonviolent offenses. And it's a program that we're renting space off International Airport Road. It's there's two teachers there and administrative support that covers that and then other alternatives. And it's an individualized program. The students come in, they work with the teacher. There's a lot of online learning. We also try and connect them back to their high school or middle school, depending on, see what their courses were, so we make sure that when the student meets the other requirements that the board requires, which would be community service and maybe some counseling. Sometimes it's a forensics exam to make sure they're not a danger to themselves and others. Then they can apply to be reinstated by the school board. That way they won't have lost all this time while they've been expelled or long-term suspended. And we've had that program probably 5-6 years now, and it was at the request of the school board because we were getting kids violating our policies and rules, but we were also seeing they're just hanging out in malls and not progressing. So we have established those kinds of programs. We've got another one that we're gearing up on called My High. It's an online virtual high school program, and I noticed next week's agenda you've got a topic on that, but we're also finding that many of these young people who are disengaged, we have been able to use technology somewhat to re-engage them, more individualize their learning, help them get credits recovered so they start to see themselves not so far off track. So we're doing a lot of those things for our suspended and expelled kids, but I will tell you, we have not stepped back from expelling students who are dangerous to themselves, there are other students and the staff, but at the same token, we're trying to work collaboratively to keep them getting some education. And then, of course, you know that with special education students who are expelled or long-term suspended for more than 10 days, we are required to provide ongoing education for them. So we have another program called Outreach for students who they're special education students who've been expelled. So we are using a lot of extra resources, but we're seeing results, but it's on a much more individualized basis for those two categories. And then I'll let Laurel talk about the administrative drop issue.
Representative
Gardner
had the follow-up.
Thank you, and thank you very much. I think there's some very good news in your response here. My other question is, do they have, are the students in these four programs you've described, if they're of the appropriate grade, included in this study that we have before us?
I'd have to ask Laurel.
Yes.
They've been expelled. Still,
they're accounted for. They're a dropout.
Right, they're a dropout,
yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Because that's one of the categories.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is Laurel Gratchik again. And one of the things I just would point out that add to Superintendent Como's comments is that she shared with you all the programs in ways that we're trying to keep kids engaged in school. And last year, our percent of those who had dropped out, the reason for expelled was 4.41% compared to in this group, it was
8.7%.
So that number is dropping because we're keeping more and more of those kids in school. The administrative drop is when during the school year a student has 10 consecutive absences and we do not have any information from the family that the student is on a vacation, there's an illness. We have, as a school, they've contacted the home number, they've contacted the work number, they've contacted the emergency contact numbers, and we cannot, they are through that process, they're not successful in contacting the family, if we have 10 consecutive days, then we drop them, and that's according to the regulations set forth to us by the Department of Ed.
Thank you.
Can I, one thing I didn't mention, but, and I don't know if this is the right time, but one
and,
of the
and Carol, would you identify yourself on the record?
Carol Como,
that's,
I'm sorry.
That's good.
The whole issue of helping parents understand how important it is, especially our non-English language learner, non-English speaking parents, understand how important it is to ask for help to keep their kids in school, to come to school regularly, not to use their older kids to babysit their younger kids if they have to go to work. That is a huge issue, and I know we're not talking about compulsory education, so it won't take much time, but one of the issues they have raised with us has been, well, the law says my child only has to go to school till they're 16, and we try and explain that's true, but we know that if a child stays in school and gets a high school diploma, they're going to have a much better set of opportunities. And that we continue to be challenged trying to explain to people who haven't necessarily, you know, grown up in our system, if you will, or they haven't gone to school much themselves because they're coming from overseas. And I don't want to digress too much because of the study, but I, at some point, I think we all need to recognize that we need to figure out that whole issue, too, because it is a truly big and growing issue in our community with as many non-English-speaking parents or whoever is raising the child, if you will, some of his grandparents and so forth, and why they need to understand why that school attendance through 18 or a diploma is so important to their children's success. So that's just one of these things that we really continue to work on.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure which one of you, whichever one of you wants to answer this would be fine, but Tuesday we learned that many times dropouts will drop out. They'll come to school the first part of the year and then they drop out, and that many times they drop out several times. Were you able to make any correlation as how many times they've dropped out, or once they drop out, that's a red flag right there?
If you look on this is Laurel Voracek. If you look on the second page, page two of the study, and again, this is an area, when I started my comments, that it's so important to really describe what it is that you're actually reporting. Because in our cohort of 770, we had 774 students who dropped out at least once. Of the 774 who dropped out, 541 students never re-entered. So 541, it was a final dropout. Among the 774 students, some dropped out once, but others dropped out more than once. So there was really a total of 1,082 incidents. So it really depends upon when you're reporting your data. And if you look through the report, these will always be referenced because, yeah, we had 541 who dropped out, never re-entered, but we had 774 who had a dropout record. And Shokian, can you tell, there, we reported what percent of those returned, the students who dropped out returned and graduated on page three. So among the 774 students who reported at least one incident of dropping out, 46 students graduated within 4 years for table two. Table two, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so yeah, we had we had 223 students who dropped out more than once, and 551 who dropped out once.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a very comprehensive study. I really appreciate all the work that went into this. This gives, I think, those people who are looking for some data in regards to a five-year look, the opportunity to look at what happens to students while it's happening to them. And if I'm correct in this, one of your benchmarks is Algebra 1. You're using a math class, or looking at a math class as one of the proving grounds for looking at where students are for graduation. A lot of the studies that we've been looking at for the last year look at reading, and those studies show that by the time that a child is in third grade, we already know most of this information. You touched briefly on a couple of issues, I think, that are very important. One of them was exit. Do we know why each of these students dropped out? I mean, it seems like, as you mentioned, there are many factors that are involved in this, and it seems to me that a lot of this revolves around caretaking for the students themselves and the individuality. I understand that the burden that we're all under here, and every year you're asked to do more analytical insight intervention. We give you more information about kids. We tell you that we want you to do more with them. It seems as though there are more and more kids in classrooms all the time where there aren't the opportunities for those kids to have the individual care or mentorship. And that is where I think the chairman mentioned we have seen some successes. Are we moving in that direction?
Well, let me start. I want to go back a bit. Are you talking about when Representative Seaton mentioned the advisory committees? Or when you said mentoring?
Yeah. Well, that was one system.
Right, and we have some schools using that, and some are more successful than others. It really depends on how the curriculum and the advisories is built. One of the things we know, and we're working closely with Big Brothers Big Sisters, with our school business partnerships, with Boys and Girls Club, we know that if there's one significant, at least one significant adult in every child's life from the time they enter school all the way through, it's going to make a difference, because somebody will care, number one, if they show up every day to school, if something's looking like it's going wrong, that there's somebody there to be that personal connection. We know that every child in our system does not have that, and we work hard to make that the classroom teacher, or we make it, if there's a nurse at the school, or a counselor, or the principal, somebody. Could be the custodian many times, but whoever, that we need to know, kids need to know there's somebody there at that school from the very first day they walk in the door that they can always talk to, that you know, they really connect with. So I think mentoring is one aspect of this, and we're working hard to get more mentors for many of our students who don't have that support system. But again, as I said before, it's very complex. And we're working hard at it, but it's a good example of something we know works, but it's also an example of having to do more at the school level, and that's where we're depending more on community agencies and volunteers, churches, the faith-based community, whatever it is, to really help us with this effort.
And this is Laurel again, and I would, just a couple comments I would make on that. It would be my dream to be able to gather together the students in this study who dropped out and be able to do a focus group with them. I spent 10 years in my profession as a counselor and recognized the value of those relationships. The one thing I will caution you is to not make assumptions. For example, the Anchorage School District graduation rate from 2004-05 to 2008-09 has gone from 59.59% to 70.48%. We cannot attribute that to one factor because we cannot isolate that. It's qualitative. We have done ninth grade academies. We have advisories. The national data tells us from the work that they were able to do with dropouts is that the curriculum needs to be more relevant and engaging. And so looking at the way that instruction is occurring, and certainly we are even looking at how we do a better job even of bridging our CTE courses with our core courses, because if we make it real, we engage students. So it's a variety. There are a variety of ways to work on those connections. We know that it's important to make those connections, but how that is done can be done in a variety of ways. And we would be remiss if we attributed our increase in our graduation rate to any one of those factors. We've added graduation coaches. I mean, there's so many that it's very difficult to isolate. I would love to be able to, you know, and maybe we'll try again in the future to be able to survey our students who are dropping out. I guess our greatest opportunity is the minute they leave our schools to be able to find them and pull them back in. And a lot of times when that happens, we're actually able to keep them in school and find other alternative programs that may meet their needs. But I just caution to make an assumption about a particular intervention or program and its impact, because it's very difficult to measure that unless you have a control group, which in schools we are just not science labs.
Laurel, can you back up and define for us CTE or explain what those courses are?
Career technology and education.
Okay.
Our career technology courses.
That's great. This is going out to the general public, and we want to make sure everybody understands.
I apologize.
No problem. We have Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Laurel, you just mentioned that it's difficult to assess specific programs, but I was curious if you had considered the impact of participation in Native cultural education programs, many of which are funded by the federal government, and if those programs have a positive impact on graduation rates.
I can't speak to those specifically, but I do know that we work very closely with Doreen Brown in the Title VII program and provide a lot of data to them for their evaluators to do an analysis of the grants that they receive. So I would not be we provide the data to them to be able to do that, but I wouldn't be able to speak specifically about what the impact has been.
This is Carol Como. One of the things that I think Doreen called in, did she call in on Wednesday for you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, she did.
One of the things we work very closely with Cook Inlet Tribal Council, and we have for a number of years, and we're kind of looking at what's working and maybe narrowing the number of schools we're working with there and doing a more concentrated effort. But we have just received this fall a five-year grant through the U.S. Department of Education and focusing on Native Alaskan children and the dropout rate and graduation rate. And we're getting some of these netbooks with the, I don't know exactly what they're called. They're a card that allows access so kids who don't have internet access at home can use this to do some projects, some writing, some things. And Doreen has told me that they're already seeing more excitement and engagement with young people. So we're trying a lot of initiatives. One of the things we've also hired is more, and I put them in through the general fund because the federal funding we get through Title VII is not adequate. So last year and this year, we've built in a considerable increase in staff for our Native education students through our regular general fund. And counselors and outreach people who really connect with the families, and many of them are Alaska Native themselves, and what's happening is they're finding that more personal connection, because once these counselors identify maybe some of the strengths of the young people and help them feel comfortable coming in, especially from rural Alaska, from our small villages into our huge high schools and middle schools and even elementary schools, that starts to break down the barriers. But we are really looking hard at how to validate the cultural need, but also hold high expectations so that we increase that Native graduation rate.
And we're doing better, but we've got too high a dropout rate, too. And we know we need to get more Alaska Native kids into higher level courses. And that starts back in the elementary school to build them up so that they're ready to take some of these rigorous courses. We've also had great success using some of our career and technical education courses, or some of our KC King Career Center vocational career tech courses in the whole area of workforce development. We're really building on our career and college ready initiatives with stimulus funding, trying to see if some of those opportunities work. And then we're going to have to make some real hard decisions when another year when the stimulus money goes away. But we're learning a lot just this year in trying to connect our Alaska Native kids in different ways where they feel more comfortable in schools.
And this is Laurel Sporacek again, and I can share with you that a report that you may want to, would be available to Doreen Brown, because I'll be presenting it in March, is our department does an analysis for them, not of specific programs within Title VII, but we do a very thorough analysis of the title of the Title VII students, and we're working on that analysis right now. It ends up being about a 50-page document. It is done every year, and we present that to her advisory committee in February. And so if you contacted her, she would be able to, she puts it on our website once it's available. And I will add too, Superintendent Como said we have a long way to go, but we are very proud of our dropout rate for Alaska Native American Indian students from 07-08 to 08-09 went from 8.54% to 5.88. And it was 9.18 in 06-07. And we did increase our graduation rate. I believe it was by 15 percentage points. We still have a long way to go, but certainly the analysis of their program, we do a separate one, but not specific to any program within her program.
Okay, thank you, Representative Keller.
First of all, thank you, Superintendent and Laurel, for bringing this to us. And the work that's been done here is going to be helpful. And working with us, we have common goals. I just wanted to express my thanks and congratulations on the improvements that have been made. Just to make sure I understand a little bit, on back on the very first thing there on page 3, table 1 and figure 1, as I understand it, the students that transferred and the students that were expected to return are not part of the study, coming up with a regression model and all that. And my curiosity is, if that is correct, has there been follow-up? I mean, has been, like the 389 students in particular that were expected to return, do we have any? Has anyone gone back and looked at that? And I understand why it might be difficult on the transferred students to have any follow-up, but just curious.
This is Laurel again. Transfer students, there would be no ability to follow up because they could transfer out of the country, out of the state, certainly out of our district. Of the 389 continuing students, we had 287 who returned to school that following year. I don't know if we have the number that actually graduated, but we have done that. I mean, I don't have it in this report. I can't pull it off the top of my head, but we do look at, for Mr. Henry asks every year of our students who return, how many actually graduate.
And Ms. Carol Como, a little further down in that those boxes, it says the 389 students are expected to continue as fifth-year seniors. And one of the things, even though it counts against us in our graduation rate, we have made a huge effort to keep kids in school, even though it counts against us, if you will, in the graduation calculation for that four-year cohort. But we want kids to get a diploma. We've got some kids that are five-year seniors, and some of them even go to summer school that summer, and we do midsummer graduations so they get that diploma. We're doing everything we can to help kids understand that importance. And so that's what, you know, that's our absolute goal. And not all of them make it, but a lot more do than did a few years ago.
and this is Laurel again, I think it's very, that effort and that emphasis that goes out to our schools and how they approach each individual student, I think is the numbers demonstrate that, because 74% of our continuing students, fifth-year students, actually returned, and that's a high percent.
Representative Keller, follow-up?
Again, just thank you for your motivation and your work on this.
You're welcome.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, and Laura and Carol, this is pretty exciting information, I think, for us to be able to have to look at. I have a question, though, and that's when those 389 students come back for their fifth year, do they just come back to normal classes that they haven't finished? Does anybody know? I mean, some of the kids probably know, but, I mean, how are they treated and what's done for them?
This is Laurel, and they, they're just like any other student. When we look at our data, most students do not graduate in 4 years, not because they have not passed the exit exam, it is because they have not completed the credit requirements. So the overwhelming majority of these students are completing credit requirements. The other, in terms of looking at our fifth-year seniors, and if they were treated differently, it would be that their courses that they are taking are, their needs are definitely, I think, more closely scrutinized so that we can keep them in school and help ensure that they're going to stay with us and graduate at either at the semester or at the end of that year. So we don't have fifth-year seniors. We don't have 12-plus. Anchorage intentionally chose not to do that. Our fifth-year seniors are grade 12 students.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is Carol Como. This is the other thing, and I think you know this, that the ASA requirements do not allow fifth-year seniors to participate in athletics. So we try and keep them truly focused and engaged in the academics so that they can get those diplomas.
Thank you. And Carol or Laurel or anyone there, I was wondering if I'm looking at page 10 of 23 of the original report there. And, you know, we're looking at 105 students dropping out in eighth grade in this cohort, 256 in ninth grade, pretty much stayed steady, dropped a little bit between 10th and 11th and 12th grade. I was wondering, do you have different mechanisms for responding to a student, whether they drop out in ninth grade versus 11th grade? Is there kind of a policy difference as far as addressing those dropouts, or are they pretty much addressed in the same way?
This is Carol. There is no difference. We address them in the same way. We aggressively try and get them back in school and figure out exactly where their deficit subject areas are, those kinds of things. And we do that regardless of the grade level. And that's why we've really worked at putting these graduation coaches in, trying to really get very intentional about the counseling, if you will, to help make it work for that particular child. But the policies are the same.
Okay, thank you. And I just, I don't see any other questions. I just wanted to really say that I appreciated working with you on the graduation rate committee, and thanks, Carol, for giving this report to us. I do want to let you and all other superintendents across the state that may be listening in to us today that if you have additional studies that are relevant to what we're doing, we have, other than, you know, just happening and getting that there, we really don't have any good mechanism for knowing what research is happening and what issues are being researched and solved across the state unless folks let us know. And so this committee is very open and would encourage any of the districts that have information, research, problems that they need help with to get that information to the committee so that we can work with you, because we all have the same goal of increasing graduation. And so I wanted to let you know that we do have another question from Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carol, I caught at the very beginning of this discussion the role that stimulus funds have played in terms of hiring counselors at the middle school and the high school level. But I'm gathering that these are positions that the district didn't have before, or certainly didn't have the funding to be able to bring into the system. Stimulus funding is going to expire here at some point, a year or two out or whatever it is. And I'm trying to get some sense of what role that this additional funding provided in this whole effort. Obviously, it wasn't there when you started the cohort study back in the eighth grade and so forth. But can you kind of help me better understand the importance of these positions, number one? And I'm inferring, and I'll stand to be corrected, that most schools probably don't have these positions or like-minded positions in their districts. And can you sort of help me better understand where I'm going with all this?
Sure. Representative Edgman, this is Carol Como, and thanks for the question. First of all, we, a year ago, before the stimulus money came into the district, we had made a decision in last school year's general fund budget, with the increases that the legislature approved for our base student allocation funding, we made a decision to hire the graduation coaches, and we put one in every comprehensive high school and split one between Eagle River and Polaris because they're smaller and they have a pretty high graduation rate, and then split part-time into SAVE and Benny Benson and Avail, our alternative programs. So that came out of our general fund, and they have been very successful. We're reducing two of them in next year's budget because the South High School, Polaris and Eagle River really have very high graduation rates, and we feel their regular counseling staff can meet the needs of the schools. But other than that, we intend to continue as best we can to fund those graduation coaches in those high schools out of our general fund, not stimulus funded. The stimulus funding allowed us to hire a middle school career guide in every middle school and Polaris. And so what we're doing with this stimulus money, which goes away at the end of the next school year, we're very clear about that. We've been clear from the beginning. These were two-year durational contract hires. They're all certificated, so if the positions went away, they can go back into the classroom. So people are very aware of that. But at the same token, what we said from the beginning, if we see value and results like we think we're going to, then we're going to make some harder decisions that we need to keep those positions and put them into the general fund and cut something else. Because what we're finding with the career guides is the relevancy of our instructional program. They're doing individual assessments with the eighth graders this year, and they're using Explore through ACT, right, for all the eighth graders. And with that, they're going to develop a long-range four-year, five-year, four-and-a-half-year plan, whether kids know they want to go the college prep way, or maybe they're interested in vocational ed, or maybe they want to go work and be an apprentice someplace, maybe they want to go to the military, whatever it is, we're trying to assess their strengths, their needs, and their interests with these career guides, and then helpfully help that transition from middle school to high school. So the reason we had this opportunity with this stimulus money, and thank you so much to the legislature for agreeing to accept that. That's an example, and we have a number of initiatives that I'd be happy to describe at another time and give you the information on what we're doing with our state stabilization and other stimulus funding. Really focusing in on this issue is how can we reengage more kids, prevent them from dropping out, get them focused on this long-range plan that they need, so at the end of the day, at the end of high school, they know what they're going to do next. And it's very complicated, as you all know, because of the economy and some other things. But that's pretty exciting for us that we've been able to hire these people that have already, the excitement among them, we heard a report from them recently at the school board meeting, what they're doing already, and it is really pretty amazing. And so we know it's going away, but we're assessing it. We're going to report back to the board, and then next year at this time when I'm adding more in my budget, but we know the stimulus money is going to go away. So that's just an example of kind of one initiative of many, frankly, that we're using that stimulus money for.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. I just got a question. Carol, I'm not sure. I know that when these kids have been, I can't remember the wording, but when they're not enrolled in school anymore, that when they, because of grades or something, that they can't take sports when they come back. But can they take drama and debate and band and things like that, or is that all activities?
Representative Wilson, this is Carol Como. We follow the ASA. You know, anything that's an ASA-sponsored activity. So if it's debate, drama, the music competition, any sports that are under ASA, they have to have a 2.0 grade point average in order to be eligible. We have worked really hard with our eighth graders who may not have that going into ninth grade. We have given them a clean slate, if you will, if they go to summer school and they work to make up their grades, because we want kids to participate, and if that's the bar. But it's on a probationary basis, and they have to, within the first quarter, they have to show that they're making grades. Otherwise, they're not allowed to participate. But that's an ASA rule as well as a school district rule.
I'll follow up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Carol, Is that a good rule? Is that something that should be tried to be worked on? How do you feel about that?
Ms. Carol Como, Representative Wilson, I think it's an excellent rule, and I'll tell you why. Some kids, the only reason they come to school is to play football or whatever, and they admit, they say, man, if I didn't have that rule, I wouldn't be in class. And they know, and the coaches really work on them to come to school regularly and keep those grades up. And it has been a huge help, because I can remember back when I was teaching many years ago, when they didn't have the 2.0 requirement, we had kids that were playing sports that had a 1.0. They just got a bunch of D's and they didn't care. When the board in the mid-80s changed that rule, it made a huge impact. And now it's been so well established that it's just absolutely the norm. And we need that hook to keep kids motivated for those activities. I mean, they can, if they don't have a 2.0, they can participate in the intramurals, they can participate in lots of those kinds of things, but the actual ASA sanctioned activities at the high school level and going into ninth grade, they cannot participate in.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
Just one last question. If there's any other suggestions that you have that where we could change or tweak something, please let us know.
Carol Como again. We will, and we will be wanting at some point to talk with you about the whole high school graduation qualifying exam issues. And we've been having numbers of discussions here with our board, with us, and we'd love to be part of those conversations too. And of course, Representative Mew knows my feelings about the age 16 issue, and I've already kind of gone on and on about that. But I think those are two things we need to have substantive discussions about.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Carol, and I tell you, we do appreciate your recognition that the increase in the base student allocation has made an effective difference in your district, and we're hearing that districts across the state are being able to do more things to keep students engaged. So I think that, if that is the case, that message needs to be sent to all of your representatives as well, and we'll look forward to working with you and everyone else. And again, I encourage you, if there are additional research data or projects that are going on that you can you want the committee to know about, make sure you let us know. So thank you again for taking your time to come in and go over this report with us, and if we have further questions, we'll email them to you as we delve through this. I'm sure there'll be some. So thank you very much.
Thank you all for allowing us to do this.
And we'll now go on to House Bill 235. I think you have that in your pamphlet. And sure. And Representative Munoz will We'll take a 2 minute ease out here while we get set up. Back to order. We are looking, or we're having a hearing on HB 235, and again, this is the first hearing on the bill, so we will be having a second hearing at a later date. Representative Wilson.
I move that we adopt for the CS for House Bill number 235, version R, dated 1-8-10.
And that's moved to adopt as a working document, and I'll object for discussion. And welcome, Representative Munoz.
Thank you very much. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce my very able staff, Kendra Kloster. She will be walking you through the provisions of the bill after my opening remarks. Chair Seaton and members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing HB 235. This is a bill that would establish a loan program through the Alaska Commission for Post-Secondary Education with a forgiveness provision for students that return to the state of Alaska. The program is geared toward healthcare professions of dentistry, optometry, and pharmacy. It's a program that would be established through the WICHE organization, which is the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. WICHE is a program that allows students to participate in programs in other states when those...
I'm sorry.
On a House committee, House Education Committee, Paul?
Me too.
If you can hear us, you're coming through on our... let's see, do we have them muted now?
I didn't do anything.
We're hearing somebody online, so...
turn your radio.
Yes, I can hear you, so if you would...
Rep Seaton?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Diane Behrens. We actually lost the sound from your end.
Okay, do you have it now?
We do.
Okay. We are just with Representative Munoz introducing the bill at this point in time, and so we're back online. Representative Munoz, we'll go off at ease.
Thank you, Chairman Seaton. WICHE is a program that allows students to participate in educational opportunities in other states, participating states, when their home states do not offer those programs. In Alaska currently, as you know, we do not have a school of dentistry or programs for optometry or pharmacy. So this would allow and encourage students to enter those professions. As many of you are aware, healthcare professionals are needed in many areas of our state. We are seeing an increased number of professionals approaching retirement age, and many of our communities are in serious need of additional healthcare professionals. An example is in the community of Ketchikan, where two dentists have actively been trying to retire and sell their practices, but the fact is that younger professionals are not coming back to their home communities, and it places a very difficult burden on practicing dentists in those communities where younger professionals are not coming back. Dr. George Schaefer of Ketchikan, I believe, is online, and he could speak to this issue in his home community. Over the years, his practice has absorbed many patients as a courtesy to retiring dentists. However, Ketchikan and many other communities are still lacking dentists and other healthcare professionals, and that leaves a real burden on those still in practice. The Student Loan Forgiveness Program starts at 25% loan forgiveness for students who return to the state and stay for 5 years and practice within Alaska for 5 years. It provides an additional 25% forgiveness for students who go to communities that have a lack of healthcare professionals or are identified as underserved areas or who cover patients under the medical assistance program. In closing, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this legislation. This is a small step that we can take to advance our healthcare delivery system by encouraging young Alaskans to enter fields of high demand in pharmacy, dentistry, and optometry. Kendra here will walk you through the specific provisions of the bill, And Diane Behrens from the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education is here to answer specific questions. Also in the audience is Dr. Christine Molesky, President of the Alaska Dental Association, and Dr. David Logan. And I believe there are other individuals online to answer questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a motion for adopting version R, so we need a rundown of the changes between the version that was introduced, version A and version R.
Sure. Kendra Kloster, work with Representative Kathy Munoz. Over the interim, what we did is we drafted the CS, which essentially is just there to clarify some of the language from the first bill. We clarified the eligibility for going up to 10% for the forgiveness if you go to an underserved area. It didn't seem quite clear in the first draft, so we went ahead and changed some of the language in Section 3. And we also went on setting the interest rate at a more competitive rate, which is now on par with the WAMI program, and that is in Section 2. And also, if you look in Section 2, with the exception of the forgiveness schedule there, the conditions of repayment are, as I said, more on par with WAMI, so we're looking at that in Section 2, Section 3, and then, yeah, that was pretty much it. If you have any questions.
Okay, I guess I have a question.
Sure.
Is the sponsor statement is talking about 25% forgiveness for now, has that been changed to 10%?
No, it's I'm sorry, Chairman Seaton, that is a total forgiveness if they return for the full 5 years. It's 5% per year up to 25%, or 10% per year if they go to an underserved area or accept Medicaid patients.
Okay, so the percentages are the same. It's just the way it's set out as an allocation. Is that correct? Okay, does anyone else have any other questions on the differences between R and A? Representative Book.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Could you go over some of the requirements for definitions of underserved areas? I appreciate the fact that you're recognizing areas where we don't have people to serve the Medicare industry, but that could be almost every community in Alaska. So I'm just kind of curious about that.
And are we talking about a difference between the two versions, R and A?
Yes, okay. I see it in A. I don't see it in the CS.
Okay.
Medically underserved is a federal definition, and I defer to Dr. David Logan to answer that question.
Okay, and so I believe I want to interject to see if I have the question right. In version A, we have a section 1444.042, which is underserved care loan forgiveness program, and identifies what this underserved is, and we don't have that in version R. Is that correct?
Is that? Mm-hmm. So,
we no longer have a 44042 section in version R.
Correct. I believe what we did is we went ahead and looked for the underserved area is a definition that goes by the Department of Health and Social Services.
So that is on line 26 or 24 of version R. It's just not set out as a separate section. Is that what we're talking about? We're still a resident of the state,
right?
And in practice. So is this just a conforming numbering? It's not that the information's been omitted? for the definition change. Yes, this Diane?
Yeah, for the record, this is Diane Behrens. As I understand the draft, it allows the Commissioner of Health and Social Services to designate an area as underserved. So that is something that could be done by regulation or some, I guess, just designation from the commissioner, official designation. And then the other sort of underserved standard, if you will, is the level of the percentage of billing for services to patients that are receiving medical assistance in a program through the state. And that's found on page 2, lines 29 to 31.
Reverend Gardner.
I think part of the confusion, and I'm trying to work it out myself, is that the original draft refers to 1444.042, and the new draft is 1444.041. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there's a drafting reason for the change in that reference.
And I believe, Representative Book, that if we look on version A on lines 28 and 29, it's the billings are not less than 5% of the participants' average gross billings for the year, and that has been changed to if the billings provided are not less than five. No, that's the same. And the participation there is 50%, which has been added. Before, we didn't have the 50% of the practice. No, that's not it.
If I might...
Yes, Representative Booth.
Well, my question refers to line 27, which gives discretion to the commissioner. And this is a rather vague definition. Is there outlines within the bill that gives definition for that? Is this... I'm asking you, sir, is this a normal procedure? We're given a great deal of latitude here in this bill.
Well, the provisions of the bill will be discussed and debated, but what we're trying to do right now is we have a motion to adopt version R as a CS. And I think if we look at the sectional might tell us what the differences are. Kendra, can you again introduce yourself and tell us the differences between version A and version R? That's what our question is, so we can get a CS adopted, but we need to know what those differences are first.
Sure. Kendra Kloster again with Kathy Munoz's office. What we did is through a clarification of some language, like I stated before, but I was going to let Dr. David Logan speak to Representative Book's question there on that specific language for the underserved area.
Okay, and if it's in both bills, mm-hmm. then we don't want to deal with it now. What we just want to deal with is a change from version A to version R, and if there's no change, then that's fine.
Okay. Sure. So for the so looking back at the changes and why we're making those certain changes, this one is if we look back on the 10% forgiveness per year, we did a clarification there because what we wanted in section 3 there was to do 10% forgiveness per year if you go to an underserved area, or 5% per year if you just return to the state. So that was one of the clarifications for the reason for the new version R. The other one we're looking at, the change that we did, was setting an interest rate that was more competitive, so we went on par with the WAMI program, which is one that we have done for the physicians. Sure, and that one we set out the interest rate to equal the 12th Federal District Reserve, so we have a more competitive there interest rate. Because currently with the WICHE program now, we have they accrue interest while they're in school. So what we're doing is making it so it doesn't accrue while they're in school, but just when they're out.
Okay. So we have a couple of technical changes. Are the changes not the majority of the bill? So we can always go back and reinstitute those technical changes the other way if we wish. So I'm going to remove my objection to adopting version R. Are there any other objections to adopting version R as our working document? Seeing none, we have version R before us. Representative Munoz.
I would like to introduce Dr. Logan to speak to this bill and also provide additional testimony.
Okay, and let's see. And Kendra, have you basically gone through the sectional here with us?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Then that would be appropriate. Go ahead, and would you introduce yourself for the record and who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Logan. I'm representing the Alaska Dental Society, and I'm a dentist here in Juneau. I've had the opportunity to meet with everybody on the committee to discuss the bill, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time reiterating my previous conversations with you. I would just like to say how much I think this bill will help the citizens of Alaska, the kids of Alaska, as an avenue to attend professional school. It's a difficult, expensive proposition to go to professional school. The loan amounts that these kids are coming out with from school now is staggering. For dentistry, $250,000 has become the norm. Higher numbers than that are not uncommon. That's a tremendous financial burden to leave school with, and sadly enough, part of that financial burden is trying to figure out how you're going to pay that money back. And consequently, kids are having to make economic decisions as to where they go and where they set up practice that maybe aren't what would normally be their first idea of where they would go. They would look more to the community they want to reside in than the necessity of paying those loans back. So I think a program like this, that while not alleviating that burden certainly, but at least taking some of the edge off, making it a little bit more palatable for them to come back to communities and financially able to do so, I think would be tremendous. Dr. Schaefer, I believe, is online, and he can discuss what's happening in Ketchikan and put a really good face, I think, on what is happening in these communities, much better than I can tell the story for that. I would like to say, though, however, so many years ago now, that I was able to attend dental school under the WICHE program. And for me, that made a tremendous difference. It was also at a time when the Alaska Student Loan Program was a little different than it is now, and that also was a tremendous help. But I was able to leave school I had debt, certainly, but it was manageable debt. And it allowed me to return here to Juneau, which was my hometown there, and establish a practice where I wanted, in a location that I wanted, and I've been here now for 20 plus years because of that. And so for me, the WICHE program was a tremendous advantage. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions on the bill. I would like to say very quickly is where the confusion came on part of the new version that came in there. We had a companion bill, Senate Bill 174, that we had a hearing on last year, and there was a lot of confusion over two avenues for forgiveness, the coming back to the state and going out to underserved areas. So we thought this would help to eliminate some of the confusion.
Okay. Thank you. And yes, Representative Wilson.
I just wanted to make a comment that I think it is a good idea for the Health and Social Services to make the decision of where the underserved areas are, and for the very reason that changes. That changes from year to year. If they got a dentist and several people in one area, then that's not won't be an underserved area anymore, and so that will go off the list, and maybe another area would come on. And so that's why that's kind of a moving target. But if they get someone in those areas, and they will get that percentage, whatever that, up to 50%, if they serve in that underserved area. Now, if they leave, then it would become an underserved area again. And so that kind of moves. And so because they have people and patients that they want served, they know where the areas are lacking certain professionals. So I think it's good that the Department of Health and Social Services is the department, because they definitely know where they have a hard time getting their clients served. So that's my comments on that.
Quick follow-up on that.
Representative Edgman, follow-up.
Yeah, not to
on that point.
Yeah, not to complicate the discussion, but last year we had a discussion on a bill, Representative Dahlstrom's legislation. I can't remember which one it was on the subject of underserved areas, but I guess my question maybe to Dr. Logan would be, this certainly would allow the commissioner of HESS to match up the state's definition with the federal definition, because there's federal loan programs that have underserved areas tied to them as well.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that's correct there. And currently, that is the statutory definition under the dental statutes for an underserved area, and that's the one of the reasons I think it was rolled in. I can't speak for the other professions. I haven't examined their statutes that are involved in this bill, but I believe that it's a common statute throughout the statutes governing the healthcare professions, that's how an underserved area is defined statutorily for Alaska.
And I think that we'll have to get with Diane here and find out, because it sounds like if we had a community that didn't have a dentist and someone started participating in there and then another dentist moved in to that area, it would no longer be an underserved area. And the question is whether that would mean that the person who was counting on a 10% reduction would now only receive a 5% reduction, or whether those things continue on through that dentist time frame. Have you had that discussion, Representative Munoz, to find out whether what the duration of that designation of an underserved community would be?
Chairman Seaton, as has been mentioned, it would be examined on a case-by-case basis, and no, I have not had that specific.
Okay. And we'll have that with Diane Barron. She's online, so we'll get there. Questions for the sponsor?
Yes.
Or the other people at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two such questions. Number one, have you looked at other states who do this, and is there any data showing that it actually really is effective in changing behavior? And then the second question is, we've had just an outpouring from citizens around the state about their difficulty in getting access to physicians. And we also have heard a lot about dentistry and the problem, and part of the response the state has made is using dental health aids and sort of making some tweaks and changes as to what they're allowed to do and under what circumstances. But the idea that we have a shortage of pharmacists and optometrists is something new to me. So what's the data on that?
I can say that the WICHE program has been successful in the 12 states that have programs under WICHE, in that they encourage students to go to states where programs in their home states are not available. And to that end, I think it's very positive when you're able to encourage individuals in your home state to seek education and then come back because of this incentive. So clearly, there is an opportunity here to increase the numbers of individuals coming back in those three areas.
Mr. Chair, follow up,
Representative Gardner.
So does this incentive match or exceed other states?
That's a good question. Kendra, do we have that? Or David, do you?
I don't have that information, but I do know that there are other programs throughout 44 other states, and if you wish, I can get that information to you after the meeting.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be curious to know, because if we're offering a 5% or a 10% per year reduction and Idaho's offering 12 or 15, well then our students who are currently studying might be inclined to go to Idaho instead of here. So I'd just be interested to know
what our competition's doing. For you. Thank you.
And you can just, of course, get that to Louie and we'll distribute it to the committee. Let's see, Representative Keller.
In a way, it is a bit of a follow-up on that, but I was just wondering about how you came up with the 5% reduction in each area, in the, you know, they're equal, and, you know, in light of, I mean, it sounds great. There's no doubt that we have a shortage of medical professionals, wide spectrum, not just dentists, and in trying to keep our budget manageable and not expanding government at a time when we are uncertain with revenues in the future. I just wondered, you know, how you came up with five people per area and how you came up with the 5%, you know, in each. Maybe we want, did you look at maybe increasing the forgiveness for those that went into underserved areas compared to those that came back to Alaska? You know, maybe that's not beneficial even. I don't know. But I'm just curious if you thought about that or if you just picked the numbers kind of out of the sky.
Well, no, they weren't picked out of the sky.
I kind of had a hunch.
That's the usual, right?
The Commission on Post-Secondary Education helped us with the drafting of this legislation, and the intention is to present a legislation that is able to be funded through the ACPE structure without the addition of additional state support. So it's to remain financially feasible within their framework.
I see.
And that's why we went with that percentage, those percentage rates.
Follow-up?
And not a greater percentage rate.
Follow-up, Reverend Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Seaton. Then I can assume safely that ACPE has prioritized this over other medical professional areas or has some kind of a comprehensive picture of the how far we're going to go, you know, on with loan forgiveness in other areas, I would assume.
Well, you know, I would encourage us to listen to the comments of Diane Behrens, and certainly I can't speak on her behalf, but
yeah.
I think she can address that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, and I may have missed this, but did we get any information about how or why we believe we need this legislation to apply to pharmacists and optometrists as well as dentists and doctors?
Okay. I understand that there are individuals online that can speak to that specific question from the pharmacy and optometry industries.
Thank you.
And I had a question on page one, line five there, where it's notwithstanding the funding priorities established under Section A, the Commission shall provide adequate funding for not fewer than five for each area, or a total of 15 people. Does that is the intention of this then so that it's notwithstanding those funding priorities, so this supersedes the funding priorities that were previously established under Section A for the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education? Is that the, and I presume that's WAMI, but I'm not sure, but is the, do we know why we are putting this priority higher than the current priorities that are in Section A of the commission?
Chair.
Yes, I would, because it wasn't my understanding that we did.
Diane, or is that you online? Would you identify yourself for the record?
It is. Diane Behrens, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And it may help to inform the committee that this bill is an industry-led initiative. The commission has not brought this legislation forward and has provided technical input to the sponsor and other interested parties, but the three fields that have been identified in the bill are the result of advocacy efforts from each of those three professional communities.
Thank you, Diane. And did you hear my question on the structure of the bill about notwithstanding the funding priorities? And unfortunately, we don't have Section A with the bill. I should have probably printed that out. But can you let us know what those priorities are, and does this elevate these three? It seems to, the wording structure elevates it above the current priorities. Is that correct? And what are those current priorities?
That is, Mr. Chair. It may help to give a little bit of background. For those of you who've been around for a while, you may recall that the Professional Student Exchange Program through WICHE was funded with general fund support for 20, 25 years or so, and then subsequent to the downturn in the oil market in 1986, the program was slowly defunded until there was no support whatsoever. In the mid-90s, there was legislation passed that would sort of revive the program, but as a loan obligation. So rather than the state providing the support fee directly on behalf of Alaska residents participating, Alaska residents were allowed, subject to the Student Loan Corporation's capacity to fund the program, were allowed to apply for loans. So the support fee becoming an individual financial obligation is rather unusual within the PSDP program. Except for Nevada, I believe all of the states that continue to send students in various graduate medical education programs are doing so at each state's expense. So there's no obligation on behalf of their residents to practice in the state. Of course, they encourage them to do so. But so getting back to the funding structure currently, because the Student Loan Corporation is expected to fund the program, other criteria were put in place. Those criteria the statute in 1444.025, which would now be 025A, allows the Commission on Postsecondary Education to establish funding priorities by regulation, and we have done so. Under the regulation, in order for a field to be included in the program, there's sort of a three-pronged criteria. One, that graduate program not be offered in the state. Two, that there be a shortage of professionals in the state. And three, that the earnings related to that profession will be sufficient to allow the person to repay the related obligation, which is substantial, is particularly when added to the other education debt most of the participants already bear. So the fields that are supported through the loan program include dentistry, optometry, pharmacy, and now I'm working on memory, I believe podiatry, physical therapy, and occupational therapy. What this bill would do is actually mandate that at least five participants in each of the three named fields would be funded each year. Because there is a forgiveness provision, the fiscal note that we are providing on this bill also indicates that the Student Loan Corporation could no longer be tapped as the funding resource. So these would become general funded programs that have a forgiveness feature, but because the forgiveness is not 100%, there would be some income stream back to the general fund as we collect on the at least up to 50% for folks who have the maximum benefit and 100% for individuals who simply don't return to the state at all.
Okay. It sounded like the criteria were basically the same criteria as used in Section A. It's elevating these at above the any other programs that would be established in Section A, mandating that there would be five of each of these before anything in Section A. Is that what I'm any of the other categories that were established by the Commission?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know, we've had a really interesting discussion earlier this morning, and what I would like to do is, instead of going through the bill at this point in time, what I'd like to do is see, we have people that have come in to testify, and I would like to get their testimony on the record. We will have this bill up again. So, and committee members, if you have questions on the structure of the bill itself, please write them down, and we'll take the public testimony since people have taken their time to come in. So, thank you, Representative Munoz. Would you like to join us again? And we will we will go to public testimony. And do we have in the audience, I believe, Alice Rehrig.
I'm here to...
Oh, not for a question, sorry. And David Logan, we've had your testimony, and we have Christine.
She's gone.
Christine is gone. Okay. And then online, we've gotten to Diane. Nancy Davis, are you online?
Yes, I'm on.
Go ahead, Nancy, would you identify yourself and who you're representing for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, be happy to. Nancy Davis, I'm the executive director for the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and I apologize, some of that sound was coming and going, in particular with Representative Minot, so if I missed something, I apologize. And I believe you should have all received a letter of support of House Bill 235 and the companion bill, Senate Bill 174. And I appreciate Diane Barron's clarification on the WICHE program and PSCP. I'm learning through this process all of the time. And I've done some research that I'd like to share with you. Dave Logan had indicated that it's not unusual for dentists to have a substantial loan amount when they graduate from dental school, and for pharmacists it's about $150,000. And the path career for pharmacy has changed over the years. It's now what's called a PharmD program or a postdoctoral program. And we don't have the College of Pharmacy. I think that this is an incentive for a career path for our students in Alaska. They can go to school here. There's a pre-pharm program that is developed, and I have students that volunteer in my office, and want, they need, what we'd like to have is in-state tuition, and when they apply to programs out of the state, there's an out-of-state differential. What I did is I didn't get all of the WICHE schools. There are 17 pharmacy schools, and I only did an average of about 9 of them, but the out-of-state tuition difference is substantial for our students from Alaska, and it's roughly, and I know the tuition has gone up since I did this study a year ago, because tuitions are going up about 4 to 5%, and that's minimum. But it roughly, it's about a 12 to 13,000 differential per year. And if you extrapolate that out over the 4 years, it's about a $49,050 difference just for our students to go to school out of state. And so I think that the 5% for 5 years, if you've got a loan debt of about $150,000, that's going to about pay the differential for in and out of state tuition. And it's an incentive for our students to come back. We need to grow our own. It's an investment in our future. I have 2 students in college right now that hopefully they'll look at healthcare as an option. And so just that's my take for the testimony today.
Okay, thank you. And if you do have that, a spreadsheet on that or the any communication that you can give us on that.
I'd be happy to share that for you. And I think it would be beneficial for you to see the differential for dental and optometry as well.
And thank you very much. Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you very much. I think we all understand the concept of growing our own for needed categories of workers across the state. In reading the letter of support that's signed by Amber Briggs, I was struck by the sentence that says, because the healthcare workforce shortage in Alaska is reducing healthcare access for our state's residents, ... we strongly support the concept. I haven't heard any, you know, data about the pharmacists that are currently in the state and what the projected need is, and I don't know that we have a shortage of pharmacists.
I can give you some statistics for that as well.
Thank you.
In 2007, actually, the state actually came up with some statistics that showed a 25% deficiency in pharmacists in the state. And what happens is because we don't have a loan forgiveness program for our students and we don't have an incentive for pharmacists to come into the state for recruitment, we have a churning of pharmacists within the state, and it's changing jobs, but it's hard to recruit pharmacists into the state and to keep them. And so we have, I think it's kind of an open, it's just kind of a circle of in and out within Alaska. And that's why this loan forgiveness is so important for Alaska students, because I think they will come back. But our numbers showed three years ago now that we had a shortage of about 130 pharmacists in the state, and it becomes a safety issue because they're working long hours, they're dispensing more medications, which can lead to medication errors. And I contacted Laura Miller, who's a senior economist with the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, and the national average of community pharmacists per 100,000 people is 5.36, and in Alaska, we only have 3.35 pharmacists per 10,000 people. To get that to that national average, Alaska would need an additional 137 pharmacists, according to Laura Miller. And this doesn't even add in the 15 Indian Health Service pharmacies that we know we have a significant number of pharmacists that are hired there.
And Representative Gardner, I think what we'll do is we'll ask, instead of getting into the numbers there, we'll ask the sponsor to get the department to send us. So if they're going to have to make those determinations in underserved areas, then they'll have
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to ask of the sponsor.
So we'll make that request of the bill sponsor.
And I would like to just make one more comment. This is Nancy Davis again, is that we're very supportive of a building a school pharmacy or having some potential of a perhaps a satellite school or something. And even if we were to develop a school of pharmacy in Alaska, we're 10 years away, 10 plus years, and we need pharmacists now. And so this just would be one way for our students, even the students in pharmacy school now, could take advantage of this loan loan forgiveness if they graduate in a year or two.
Okay, thank you very much, Nancy. We've got a few other folks here. Tim Towell, are you online? How about George Schaefer?
Yes, I am.
We are over time, but we wanted to give you an opportunity to make a few comments. We will have the bill up again, and public testimony will remain open. But can you go ahead and give us a short testimony now if you won't be able to return when we bring the bill up?
Yes, my name is George Schaefer. I'm a dentist practicing in Ketchikan, been here for 32 years. I think we're all in agreement that there are shortages. Part of it's developed because the baby boomers are retiring and the schools haven't trained as many people in the years since. There's regional economic differences and some differences with getting loans both for going to school and for setting up practices because of the changing economy. Well, one of the things I think that we need to take a look at is the definition of shortage areas. Many years ago, we had the state that defined what a shortage area was. And that ran into some difficulties because the definition wasn't very well spelled out. And the end result was the state quit designating in shortage areas and fell back to using the federal definition of shortage areas. And this worked well because most of the repayment programs were federal money anyway, so the federal definition was good. But if we're getting into this, I think we need to take a look at allowing the state to designate areas that the federal government might not designate to help to serve the state's needs. So with the bill allowing the commissioner to designate shortage areas brings us back about 30 years to put the state more in the driver's seat rather than totally rely on the federal government. So I think that's something that we should definitely take a look at. Another problem is that there are a group of students that are already in the pipeline in school that have gone out, let's say they get their bachelor's degree, but the differential in tuition to go to the graduate schools is so high that they drop their Alaska residencies for the purpose of having better tuition rates at school, and they wouldn't qualify for this program unless we put some kind of wording in there that it would allow them to renew their Alaskan residencies and then qualify for such a program. Because this looks like it's a student that is stuck on maintaining residency the whole way through their education program which means they have to pay much higher tuition at certain schools. So I think I'll stop my testimony there and be available for questions.
Thank you, and if you have additional comments, go ahead and submit them in writing or when we have the bill back up again.
Thank you.
Thank you again. We have one other person, Barry Christensen. Are you online?
Yes. Chairman Simmons, can you hear me?
Yes, and again, we are over time, so go ahead and proceed.
Yeah, I'll keep my comments brief. Thank you for allowing my testimony. My name is Barry Christensen. I'm a pharmacist also from Ketchikan. 25 years ago, I was attending pharmacy school under the WICHE program as an Alaska resident. It made a big difference in my ability to go to school. I also qualified for the Alaska State Repayment Program at that time, which again was another incentive for me to return back to my home, which I did. There is definitely a shortage of pharmacists in Alaska, and I know that because every time I go to schedule a vacation, I have to do it months ahead of time. We just don't have pharmacists sitting around to do that. So I would urge the committee to keep doing their diligence and to hopefully get a bill passed that helps us retain. And one more thing is that every year I have students from the high school come down and interview me, and there's a good interest in students wanting to go to pharmacy school in my community. But every time I interview them, I wonder in the back of my mind if they'll really come back, if they, like George Schaefer just said, attend school out of state, go ahead and stay there to get the residency, and then we might not ever see him again. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barry. And I've just been told that Tim Towell may be online. If you are, we would allow you to go ahead and make short testimony today or submit in writing or come back for our additional hearing. Are you there, Tim?
I am. Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Toll. That's Jim with a J. And I really have nothing substantial to add, simply to reinforce the messages, particularly that you heard from Dr. Schaefer and Dr. Logan. As the executive director of the State Society, I would like to add, however, that this bill, Alaska is now at a point where we have sons and daughters of practicing professionals, not only in dentistry, but all across healthcare. And this really would be very beneficial to aid those good young Alaskans in coming back. I won't take the committee's time any further, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the comments. One footnote, I've been fading in, and you have been fading in and out during this whole conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and thank you for letting us know that, and we will have this bill back up again. I wanted to make sure that the committee and staffers knew that there's a legislative workshop on solutions to get and keep healthcare professionals in Alaska. That's on Tuesday the 26th, and that'll be from 7 to 10:30 in the morning, and it includes breakfast. So if staffers or legislators want to look at that, that's on this subject. So that's why I'm bringing up. Representative Munoz,
Chair Seaton, thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. And we will follow up with specific data on the questions that were raised today. I heard from Representative Gardner a question about wanting percentages of forgiveness from other states, and we'll get that data for you. And then we heard about the deficiencies in dentistry and pharmacy, but we will also get statistics for optometry as well. And then we'll have somebody from the department to address the underserved question from Representative Book. And then the department will continue to work with ACPE on the GF, and we'll have, I'm sorry, the fiscal note, and we'll have that available as well.
Thank you. And Representative Gardner, one further?
I'll just talk to her.
Okay. We will be adjourned at 10:15. And thank you for the committee for staying overtime.